From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's interesting, fun, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Our next guest, Leander Caney. He's the best-selling author of Inside Steve's Brain, Johnny Ive, the genius behind Apple's greatest products, and The Cult of Mac. He's also the editor and publisher of cultofmac.com. He's with us this morning to talk about his new book, Tim Cook, The Genius Who Took Apple to the Next Level. In 2011, Tim Cook was named CEO after Apple lost its visionary founder, Steve Jobs. Pundits predicted disaster. And how do you replace someone who's irreplaceable? Well, this book tells how Tim Cook may, in fact, be the person that has. Leander, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hey, good morning. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you on the program. Tim Cook is a different kind of leader than Steve Jobs, and Tim appears to be a different kind of leader than most of the CEOs in the Fortune 100. How did his upbringing in the South inform his values that he brings to Apple today?
Yeah, that's a good question. Of course, the South is a very conservative place, and Tim Cook has actually been bringing some, very progressive values to the company. Which is kind of surprising because, he seems to be like an unlikely candidate to do that. His predecessor, Steve Jobs, was a bit of a hippie. He had long hair, he dated rock stars, he lived in a commune. You'd think that Apple under Steve Jobs would be a lot, would be a more progressive company, but it actually wasn't. It took someone like Tim Cook to really focus on things like the environment, inclusion and diversity, and these other values that he's been bringing to the company in post-Steve Jobs era.
But a gay man growing up in the South, a fairly rural environment, how did that environment inform the values that he brings to Apple?
Yeah, so I think, like you said, being gay, he had to keep that under wraps. Something had to be very, it wasn't acceptable. He had to be quiet about it. And it informs things like inclusion and diversity. He's been making a big push at Apple to make it more inclusive, make it more diverse. Like a lot of companies, it tends to be very, very male and very white. And he's trying to change that. And they're actually, Apple under Cook is ahead of its rivals. It is more diverse than companies like Facebook and Google and Microsoft. And he sees this as, not just the right thing to do, but a good business thing to do. Apple's customers are all over the world. 50% of them are probably women. And if you're developing products, if men are developing products, they're probably not taking into account, the things that, the kind of features that women want. And Apple's rightly coming to some criticism for things like, the Apple Watch. It doesn't track things like, female health, menstrual health, ovulation, stuff like that. And that's the kind of product that this is what Tim Cook wants to change at Apple. He wants to get more women onto the teams, more people of color, to have their voices heard. And in turn, that informs the kind of products they make.
You know, it was interesting when I saw in your introduction, Leander, that informing Tim Cook was his homosexuality and having grown up in a small town in Alabama. But once I started reading your book, I realized that more it was the latent and sometimes very nuanced and sometimes very overt racism in Alabama, although the town he grew up in was 85% white, and there is a lot of denial of racism in among that group, especially as Tim Cook has sort of let it leak out into the media what, his experience was as a young boy, seeing crosses burning and that sort of thing. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, right. As a teenager, he was riding his bike one night, and he came across the Klan burning the cross on one of his neighbor's lawns, and he said that he shouted, stop, instinctively without thinking about it. And one of the Klansmen lifted his hood, and it turned out to be a pastor from a nearby church, not a church that his family went to, but he knew who it was. And he said he was very shocked by that. It was an ugly side of his community that he really rejects. And This is one of the things that they've been asking him. They're sort of rightfully proud that someone from their small town has become the CEO of the largest company in the world. And they want him to bring, you know, some of Apple's wealth and power back to Alabama. And they've asked him, because, you know, the area is suffering from a lack of jobs. You know, would you bring, why don't you put an Apple call center here? Why don't you put an Apple factory here? But he won't do it because Alabama doesn't have strong anti-discrimination laws. And he has told lawmakers there that when Alabama puts some anti-discrimination laws on the books, then he'll think about bringing, you know, some of Apple's economic power back to the region. But until they do that, he doesn't want to, he feels that it's an important part of worker protections, and he thinks that the legislature should step up and do something before, about that before Apple gets involved economically in the area.
Very interesting. If you're just joining us, our guest is Leander Caney. He is a tech writer and has written many books on Apple. Now is bringing us a book called Tim Cook, The Genius Who Took Apple to the Next Level. So the way that Tim was as a young man and a boy in high school, even, he was the salutatorian of his high school class. He was very beloved. People respected him. He was he went along much unlike Steve Jobs, perhaps. He was sort of towing the line and again, very different than Steve Jobs, who was sort of rock star status and doing everything sort of outside of the box. But this is what makes Tim Cook so great in the position that he is, or part of it anyway. He was known as the operations guy instead of the big idea guy.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And this is why people thought he would fail. You know, when he took over, people predicted that Apple was going to be, they're going to start a long, slow decline. But the opposite has happened. You know, it's three times the size it was when Steve Jobs was around. But, you know, I think one of the things that people didn't really realize was that two things is that Tim Cook was a major architect of Apple's success under Jobs. And Jobs never really had the patience or the temperament to be a CEO. And in fact, you know, if you look at his career, he was actually, you know, quite a terrible CEO for most of his career. But he was good at hiring people, and he was good at hiring people like Tim Cook. And he was good at hiring people like Tim Cook and empowering them to take over these roles. So when Jobs was sick with cancer and Cook took over as the interim CEO, he's been kind of, and this was like in 2000, when was it? In the sort of, I think 2008, the late 2000s. Cook has sort of been in that role as CEO even while Jobs was around. He was also a major architect of Apple's success before that, you know, in this kind of, in a COO role, a quasi-CEO role. This is one of the things that he hasn't really gotten credit for, because he never had a public profile, and he didn't do any interviews. He's always been in Steve Jobs' shadow, so people didn't really get to know who Cook was until he, you know, these last few years when he's been running the company.
Well, of all Steve Jobs' hires, Johnny Ive and Tim Cook may have been the best hires he ever made. And Tim Cook, with his operations experience at IBM, I mean, you go into great detail about his work ethic and about his ideas and how he was identified early at IBM as someone that they need to keep an eye on, because this is a guy we need to cultivate. So it wasn't just the factory floor, but he was brought into all the different pieces of the organization and really developed a very well-rounded set of experiences that would inform him as a CEO. And there were the pundits, of course, that predicted disaster, and a lot of people thought it wasn't a good move. But he didn't just grow Apple. When he took over the helm of the ship, Apple was not in good shape. They had an inventory problem. They were building things in a factory of the future that wasn't really operating well, or it had to be closed. And they had all sorts of problems on the operation side that needed to be fixed. And it was Tim Cook that was able to do all that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like you mentioned, he got his apprenticeship at IBM. IBM was an early pioneer of what they call just-in-time manufacturing, which is famous in the automotive manufacturing world, but really hadn't really been applied to computers. And what just-in-time manufacturing is basically products are built on demand, and you don't buy a lot of parts, and you don't sit on huge inventories of built computers. And this was Apple's problem. They were really bad at forecasting. They would buy a lot of parts, and they would sit in warehouses that would cost them millions and millions of dollars to sit on that stuff. And then either they built too many computers that they couldn't sell, or they built too few computers and they couldn't meet demand. And they needed someone. And so Cook, you know, he had a very good education at 12 years at IBM. And like you said, they moved him around to all these different jobs. IBM was very good at training people internally for leadership positions, and it put them in all these different jobs and really taught them that, you know, the entirety of the business. So had a really, really good education in computer manufacturing that Steve Jobs had recognized immediately in their interview. In the first 5 minutes, they saw immediately eye to eye. Jobs knew that this was somebody with the expertise to really turn around Apple's terrible manufacturing operation. And they were, at the time, they were like 6 months of, you know, from running out of money and going into bankruptcy. So he really needed someone like Tim Cook to come in and really sort out Apple's problems. And this is another thing that Cook doesn't really get credit for, is that, you know, he really turned around Apple's manufacturing operation within like a year. They went from having some of the biggest losses in Silicon Valley to being one of the most efficient companies in Silicon Valley. You know, they were turning products around, what they call inventory turns, in just a few days. So it really allowed Apple to save a lot of money that they were previously wasting on their manufacturing operation. It's really an efficient operation. And, of course, allowed the company to survive. And then with Steve Jobs turning out these hit products, it turned into this massively successful partnership.
I think prior to it, as you write in your book, prior to Tim Cook joining the organization, Johnny Ive and his design team were, of course, designing great products and running around the world, working with suppliers and working with different people, and they're staying first class, and they're treated like, you know, rock stars. And the operations people were sort of this thing off to the side, and Tim Cook made operations cool. And the systems that he put in place and the way he listened to the employees, I mean, he really changed the way operations was looked at within the organization, didn't he?
Right, absolutely, yeah. Like you said, operations was something that was kind of, it was kind of, sort of, you know, they were like the custodians, the janitors, you know, they really weren't respected in the operation. Tim Cook's team, because they were so good and so efficient and so important to the company, they their status became elevated, like you said, towards, you know, up towards the status of the designers, who really were the top people at the table. But it's a good combination, you know, because you want to have that kind of balance. There's always been this kind of tension between the designers and the engineers, and when Steve Jobs came back to the company, the engineers were in charge. And the designers were the ones who were at the sort of bottom rung of the ladder. And so the designers would say, we want to do this, and the engineers would say, no, that's impossible. And, you know, the designers wouldn't be able to do anything about it. And likewise, you know, the operations people, you know, a big part of Apple's success and a big part of why Tim Cook is so important to Apple is that they wouldn't, you know, by definition, they wouldn't be this successful if they couldn't make these products in such quantities and make them so well. You know, Apple's products are so beautifully made, they're really well designed, but they're also really, really well made. And they're made in their millions. The scale of their operation is mind-boggling. You know, the factories where they build these, it's just as far as the eye can see. And there's factory after factory. They're churning out, you know, this is sort of unprecedented in the history of the industry, the numbers of products they're turning out. You know, so it's super important that they have a really good manufacturing operation. And this is why, you know, their status has been elevated.
Yeah. Well, as you said, when Tim Cook came to Apple, it was in 1997, at which time Apple reported a net loss of just over $1 billion. That was in just 1997, and already seeing profits by the end of 1998. You started to talk about supply chain, which I think a lot of people don't understand, and you introduced it by talking about not storing you know, hundreds of thousands of computers that they had already been manufactured at a very high price, that storage. So this is part of supply chain. What else can you tell us about supply chain that Tim Cook sort of either pioneered or initiated from what he had already known about at IBM?
Yeah, well, the big change is, you know, is outsourcing. Apple used to make all of its own products in-house. It had factories in the U.S. that were making factories here for the domestic market. It had factories in Europe for the European market. It had factories in Japan and in Asia. I'm sorry, in Singapore for the Asian market. And they were really inefficient. You know, they were supposed to be making these products for their respective markets, but sometimes they would partly assemble a computer in Singapore, and then it would get shipped back to America for some further assembly, and then it would get shipped back to Asia again for it to be sold. It was terrible. It was like a giant mess. And Cook, you know, slowly outsourced a lot of their manufacturing, and he slowly phased out Apple's own factories. And of course, today Apple doesn't run its own factories. Almost everything it does is outsourced. It works with its partner. And of course, you know, this is hugely controversial. It's been a big part of the sort of hollowing out of American manufacturing. And at the moment, the Trump administration is in a trade war with China that we could, you know, that could very well have a big effect on Apple's operations in overseas. You know, they may get hit with tariffs later this year. The Trump administration hasn't actually announced what they're going to do. But the outsourcing, it's proven to be, you know, remarkably successful for Apple. You know, there's a big debate to be had about whether it's the right thing to do or not. But, you know, their partnership with all these different companies, especially companies like Foxconn, which, of course, was controversial because of the treatment of its workers. But, you know, it's been a model that has, you know, that's worked really well, really well for Apple. And, of course, it's a model for a lot of the rest of the high-tech industry. I mean, almost all of our electronics these days are built in China.
Right. So outsourcing, and you just touched on something I wanted to ask you more about, is Foxconn. You go into, it's a Taiwanese company, I believe. And something I wasn't aware of is how much consumer electronics, and especially Apple products, are built in large part by hand, not by machines or robots, but by hand. And I'm wondering how Tim Cook's influence over, you know, discrimination and sort of fairness in the workplace, how much that has influenced a company like Foxconn, who, labor practices within Foxconn are questionable, you know, even though it sounds like their campus has been made into like a small city that with a lot of amenities. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, of course, you know, Foxconn is famous for this rash of worker suicides that occurred in 2009, 2010, when Steve Jobs was in charge. And this, of course, is when the iPhone was really taking off. And every year, they were selling twice as many iPhones as the year before. And one of the secrets about Foxconn is people say that, you know, companies like Apple use Foxconn because of cheap Chinese labor. And that is true. It definitely helps. But the real issue is capability. You know, Foxconn runs this massive city with, you know, 800,000 to a million workers there that are building products for all kinds of companies, you know, from Hewlett Packard and Dell and of course Apple. And so they have these massive numbers of workers. And if a company like Apple comes in and says, okay, we want to build twice as many iPhones this year as we built last year, Foxconn can accommodate that. They can suddenly, arrange for several hundred thousand workers to switch over to an Apple line and start building Apple phones instead. And this is the real secret of a company like Foxconn, is its flexibility. That's why it's so useful to contractors like Apple. But, you know, with it comes this huge price, you know, all this pressure that the workers were put under a lot of pressure. And, you know, some of them buckled under the pressure, and there were these suicides. And the company's reaction to it was kind of heartless. You know, I mean, they put up suicide nets in the dormitories to try to catch people who jumped. And they didn't really make any real reforms in how the factories were run. But the funny thing is that since Tim Cook has taken over in the last 6 years or so, Apple's become really vigilant about conditions in the factories of its contractors, and it's drawn up this contractor code of conduct, which has become very serious about enforcing. And so in the last 6 years, they really have reformed how the factories are run, and they're much less like, you know, the sort of these kind of harsh sweatshops that they used to be. Now they have very strict rules about how many hours workers can work, how much overtime they can, you know, they do, how much, you know, they've eliminated things like forced overtime. They've eliminated things like bonded labor. They've eliminated things like child labor. So these days, the factories look a lot more like, you know, their Western counterparts. If you went into a factory, one of these factories, it would look very much like, you know, a factory that would be run in America. And of course, it's not perfect. You know, they're not unionized. The workers don't have collective bargaining. They're not allowed to, like, group together. But the conditions are a lot less harsh than they used to be under Steve Jobs. And this comes from Tim Cook because of his, you know, his experience and his training. And his, he started his career, you know, in factories working for IBM on the factory floor. And so I think he had a lot more compassion for the conditions and that the workers are working in. And has really worked hard and has really reformed it the last 6 years or so.
I think it's really really easy for someone to simplify a technology product cycle. You know, somebody thinks of an insanely great product. You design it, you build it, you ship it, and then you start over on the next rev. And people really don't think about the scale of the operation. And you touched on it a little bit, but let's talk about it a little bit more. I mean, the iPhone X sold an estimated 55 million units in the first couple of months. And at that scale, Apple needed factories to produce 1 million units a day at peak volume, which would require 750,000 workers. The assembly line, and this is from your book, at Foxconn is 110 meters long, roughly a little longer than a football field. And people are, I think there's 60 or 70 stations, so they're about the width of a human being apart from each other, and these phones are just moving through. Can you talk about, help us understand the scale of this operation and the scale of supply chain and all, and some of the other pieces that go into this?
Yeah, you just described it from the book. Like you said, I think people have this idea that products, you know, are kind of fairly easy to put together. And fairly easy to manufacture. You know, like Apple's got a lot of controversy at the moment around these keyboards for their MacBook Pros, there's a lot of complaints that the keys get stuck. But it takes it's like turning a massive ship, you know, to make design changes, to introduce new features. A lot of this stuff is planned out like 3 years in advance. So Apple's already working on, you know, we're talking, you know, you may have the latest iPhone right now, but Apple's probably already working on two generations down the line. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, how these things are made. It takes, you know, 3 years. If there's a major redesign, it takes 3 years to design the factories and the manufacturing processes to make these phones in such huge numbers. You know, a lot of smaller companies can be a lot quicker, can turn around because they can do things on a much smaller scale. And Apple kind of almost operates like, you know, they can make, other companies can make smaller batches of phones. But when, you know, you're going to be making a product that's going to be selling 55 million in its first couple of months. The commitment to that is massive. You know, you have to have not one plant, but, you know, maybe a dozen plants just for the assembly. And then there are, all the way down the line, you know, there are plants that assemble the subcomponents and then the sub-subcomponents. So Foxconn may be employing, 750,000 people to assemble the phones before the launch. But if you look all the way down the supply chain, there are hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people involved in making all the different components that go into it. And if, you know, you've got to make sure that if you're going to come up with a new design, like say a new camera, they're selling on somewhere in the region of like 200 million iPhones a year. So they have to make sure that the sub-suppliers are able to make, you know, 200 million lenses. You know, the scale of thing is just mind-boggling, and this is why when there's all this talk about bringing the jobs back to the States, I think people have a very sort of simplistic view about what it would take. It's not just a question of like putting them together. You know, of course Apple may be able to put in some factories where people could assemble these things, but there's all these assemblies, all these other components, you know, and if you look at something like a phone, it's hugely complex. There's all these chips, all these different components, like the cameras, the screens, the different radio chips, the antennas. There's a lot of there's so much effort that goes into this. It would be a massive. It took you know, a couple of decades, 2 or 3 decades, for all this stuff to be offshored. It's going to take 2 or 3 decades for this sort of stuff to come back if people want to try to bring it back to the United States. So the scale of the operation is massive. It is really, truly mind-boggling.
And to take this scale and to take it to even a higher level of complexity, in Apple's 2017 Environmental Responsibility Report, they said that they're shooting to be able to build new products with just recycled materials. That takes it to a whole new level, doesn't it, Leander?
Yeah, it's a very interesting idea, and there's been a big push for this within the sort of the design and the manufacturing community to try to make this sort of cradle-to-grave, closed-loop manufacturing system. And it's a great idea. One of the advantages Apple has is that, you know, say for example, like the aluminum they're using for the cases for the iPhones, you know, the back of the iPhone, some of the previous generations were made up from aluminum. The aluminum is so good, but it's actually better quality aluminum comes from recycling the products than it does from, you know, sourcing it originally. And the stuff they're getting out, you know, from the smelters and from the raw aluminum suppliers. And of course, you know, this is the only way that the Earth is going to survive. If we can't continue to extract stuff from here. It is eventually going to run out. You know, there's already shortages of precious metals, things like cobalt. The only way to be able to, you know, to continue this cycle is you're going to have to capture it. You're going to have to recycle these materials. And so Apple's been making some strides, some inroads into this. They have these robots called Daisy that automatically disassemble iPhones, and they can do this at a pretty high rate. You know, one of the dirty secrets about the electronics manufacturing business is it's really, really primitive. People think that it's kind of, fairly sophisticated what they can do, but it isn't. You know, what they tend to do is they tend to shred the products. You know, they just shred them into their pieces, and then they stick a big magnet over it. And then there's some little bit of chemical processing, too, to try to get some of these materials out. But most of it goes into landfill, or it gets shipped off to countries like in Asia or in Africa, where, you know, people pick over this. And one of the reasons Apple eliminated some of the poisons from things like plastic cables was because recyclers were burning the old products to try to get, you know, precious metals out of them.
Get
but
to the
meantime,
copper.
Right, stuff, and gold as well. I mean, there's a lot of gold in electronic products, but that, you know, by burning it, they're releasing all these toxins and breathing it in. So, you know, this it's a big problem, and it's not easy to do. They have to, it's another level of complexity to try to design a product that's not designed just, you know, for beauty, for utility, for ease of manufacturing, but then for recycling as well. It adds in a whole new level of complexity, but it's a project that I think they're really committed to. And when you get someone with Apple's resources looking into this, you know, that we can probably see big change because of the commitment and the amount of resources, the amount of money they're going to put into this. So it's an interesting idea. We'll see how far they go with it.
Leander, we only have a minute left, and Lynn has one final question. Lynn, go ahead.
Well, I just think you brought up so many interesting comments in your book, the iPhone being the single most successful product of all time, 1.2 billion sold. 4 years, Steve Jobs had his hand on that project, and the other 6 years, Tim Cook has had his hands on that project. The Apple Watch was never touched by Steve Jobs, and now looking forward to a $10 billion annual sales of things like the wireless headphones, the AirPods, and the Beat headphones. Wow, Tim Cook could be the replacement, is the replacement for Steve Jobs.
Yeah, we'll see. You know, the big question over Tim Cook is, you know, can he innovate? Can he introduce the next giant product to take over from the iPhone? And I think you know, even Steve Jobs would have trouble coming up with something to rival the iPhone.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the kind of product that comes along every few decades. And I think it's, you know, here to stay. People talk about maybe augmented reality glasses, which could be a big product, we'll see. But it's going to be difficult to come up with something to rival the iPhone. Even someone like Steve Jobs, I think, would have trouble doing that. But they have a lot of things cooking and you know, say things like I said, augmented reality glasses, but also an autonomous car, robot car. I mean, if Apple comes out with a robot car and it's successful, that could be really a very, very big and transformative product. I mean, that would change not just the way you commute, but, you know, all sorts of things like, you know, the way businesses run, vacations, travel, real estate, you know, urban planning. That would really be a big, very big and transformative product. So it'll be interesting to see how successful they are with that.
The book is Tim Cook, The Genius Who Took Apple to the Next Level. Leander Caney is the author. Leander, thanks so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio. Great book.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for the opportunity.